Good evening. James McCanney here with my Science Hours. Actually, this will be a recording of the introduction of my new book. And with me is Brad Walton, who has interviewed me many times from a radio station in the Twin Cities metro area called WCCO.
CBS days, Jim.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is a station that at night would crank up the power and would be heard from Mexico to the Caribbean to Nova Scotia through Canada, any place east of the Rockies.
We were actually heard in downtown Heathrow, or at Heathrow Airport in London at one time.
Uh-huh. I would believe it. I know, because we got the reaction. But anyway, Brad is with me tonight, and he will be kind of reversing roles. He's going to interview me with the new book and the introductory, for some people, the first time they've heard the title of the book. Brad, why don't you read the title?
Absolutely. The title is The Diamond Principle. And it is an intriguing title, and I have to tell everybody listening that you were one of my favorite guests. You were very gracious, joined me many times, and this is unlike anything else you've done, and yet it embraces everything else you have done. And it's also kind of a look into the future.
Right. Well, that's what I wanted to do with this book, and this book has been on my mind for a long time.
Yeah.
And the term, the Diamond Principle, was something that I not only thought of, but I researched.
Yeah. And it's an intriguing title, Jim. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, it's not a topic or a title that's been used. Let's put it that way. It's not been overworked. Secondly, it encompasses what I envisioned here. And so the book, let me just say briefly, is a journey of the mind. And today we're beset with a world full of problems. But the things are crashing down around people, and they're wondering, where do we go? Well, how did we get here? Where are we going to go? What's going to happen in the future?
We're overwhelmed.
Absolutely overwhelmed. And I am personally. I mean, I maintain as well as anybody else. But it's just everything that's happening is just, from the insurance bill going up every month to oil flowing endlessly into the Gulf of Mexico, across the entire spectrum. And we live in a part of the world where things are good.
Yeah.
I travel a lot to third world countries, and the conditions are deplorable, horrible, beyond human belief. So anyway, the concept of the Diamond Principle is that we live in a multifaceted world. And also, I want to tell people up front that when you read the book, you're going to go on a journey. And it's like you started out at some place you know. But on the journey, you get all on the bus and you're driving around up the hills and over around turns and looking over valleys, and you're seeing something, many things that you think you've seen before. But as you go through the journey, as you weave and get farther and farther along and make more turns and bends, something is going to happen to you, and it's going to change not only the way you think, but the way you're going to act in the future. So this is a book that is going to, it's a very craftily written book, I'll tell you that. It's unlike any book I've ever written before. It is based on all of my science. It incorporates the Calculate Primes work. And it takes a 90-degree turn from anything I've done before.
Yeah. When you talk about one thing that pops up here quite often is the connection between some things that we don't often take the time to think about in terms of, I guess one of the questions is how we got to where we are today. As you talk about this journey, and you really give us a very clear map of, you know, the implications of science, the old science or the bad science, and economics. I mean, you cover a lot of different pieces here. And again, you connect the lines, as I said often on the program. Nobody says it like you. And you connect some things here when you talk about old science and the, now you have different terms here that I just want you to kind of explain here when you talk about the Diamond Principle.
Great. And the thing is, as the book proceeds, I go through a discussion. And all of a sudden, I say, this is another principle in the Diamond Principle. In other words, it's a concept. And basically, here's the way I see it. there are universal laws and truths. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't depend on us being here on Earth. That would be true if we were on the far side of the universe. And so what I tried to do is in my study and my thoughts to reach out into the universe and try and pick up on these universal truths.
Yeah.
And that's where society is stumbling.
We've lost the master key. The other term I wanted, and this is what they'll read often in the book, and it's brilliant, bad science and bad astronomy. And say, well, huh, what's the connection there in terms of why we are where we are today?
Right. And understand that a lot of scientific theories that I call standard science or NASA science or what have you, which reaches into almost every branch of study, archaeology, geology, evolutionary biology, mm-hmm. the study of man, history, anthropology, you name it, the study of ancient animal extinctions. Everything we see today has a scientific twist. And a lot of these concepts came along at a time when that seemed to be a good idea at the time. Mm-hmm. But now, what we're finding is that many, if not almost all of these concepts are simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
And for very simple reasons. Simple reasons that the average person on the street can readily see.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to ask the question, well, why is this remaining that way? One night I was on a show with Art Bell, and I had been interviewed by him many times. And we were talking about the comet theory, and he was, you know, very much, and like just about everybody out there today, realizes that comets could not be dirty snowballs, that my comet theory mm-hmm. is correct. But Art was saying, you know, why are they so adamant about staying with this dirty
yes.
snowball concept?
Right.
And at first I said, this was, but it was a Christmas show. I remember I was at a ski resort, and I went up there to do specifically mm-hmm. to be in this very nice setting to do that Christmas show.
Right.
And I said to Art, I think it's egos and things like that. And I said, it's, you know, traditional science. The journals are full of these articles, and it just would be an embarrassment. He said, no. He said, those things can all change. Something bigger is going on here. And, of course, Art had that perception of a surgeon's knife cutting through soft tissue,
mm-hmm.
you know. And afterwards I thought, you know, I think he's right. At first I kind of resisted, but I thought, you know, yeah, there is something more. And, of course, over the years I've realized that, yes, there is more. So the very subtle story is that a lot of these scientific theories were started with good intentions. They were started with what seemed to be a good idea at the mm-hmm. time. But all of a sudden, about maybe 20 years ago, there was a nefarious takeover of science. And NASA, all of a sudden, all the scientists had to sign non-disclosure agreements. They couldn't talk to the public. And so what happened is all of a sudden science became an owned commodity. And it became divided.
Yeah.
And well, I divided it into what I call tier one, tier two, and tier
Absolutely.
Three science. So there was this division of real science up above where the public never saw it. That's what I call tier one. But the garbage science, this leftover hack mm-hmm. science from long ago, remained in, and that's what you see on the Discovery Channel, on the History Channel, mm-hmm. on the National Geographic. You open up a National Geographic magazine or see a National Geographic special about the planets. You constantly see on the NASA channel or mm-hmm. NASA scientists on the History Channel or textbooks
right.
And so on. And so the question is, why do we have this, what I call bad science and astronomy? That's the term mm-hmm. I use throughout the book. Why is it so prominent today, and why is it being forced on the public when most of this could not possibly be true, and you can very
right.
obviously see it?
Was this division of Tier 1, Tier 2, Gem intentional by the powers that be that from years ago? It almost seems that because of the way it's been perpetuated and in what it's led to in terms of the other things that you talk about in the Diamond Principle, the new book, it seems that there was some real intent behind this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you see historically, say in Old Egypt,
mm-hmm.
if you look at Babylon, if you look at any of the great civilizations throughout history, this type of division where the intellectuals, the ones who really knew what was going on, mm-hmm. were divided out and they were somewhat taken over by the elite. And the information given to the public was very twisted, very distorted, and that was okay for them, and that was promoted on the common level, and the common people picked it up at the time. And this has carried throughout history. So now we have, in this world today, this what we, you know, I termed the secret societies when I wrote the Atlantis to Tesla. The issue that I talked about in the Atlantis to Tesla book with the secret societies was that these societies have carried over from ancient times. And they have a lot of information, and a lot of that information has to deal with manipulation of the public. How do you control the public? And, of course, the Diamond Principle, one of the things that I try and stress in there are these control mechanisms, and that the public has to become aware of them, and in a lot of sense, the public is waking up, but not on a big enough scale. And so, but the whole point is that, yeah, this division of tier one, high-level information, only being owned by the elite. It's an elite knowledge. They give you the garbage information. This is what they want you to think. They have their news media out there. Today we have television. But they want you to be worried about the economy. There's always a war over here. There's always this over here. And they have you completely, you know, the idea that there are economic cycles. There are no such things as economic cycles in a real economy because things don't change like that. These are planned, and so that they basically draw wealth out of the society on a regular basis.
If you create enough fear, you can have more control.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so it feeds, and so the average person out there just thinks, oh, this is just a cyclic thing. There's an ad I saw on TV for an investment group. I don't know what it was, but this woman is going, well, I know things are cyclic, and I hope my investments will come back, so all I have to do is just keep investing, and someday my investment will come back because they're cyclic. You know, and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, lady. You know, this is what they want you to believe. And so these misconceptions, they're in nightly TV shows. They're in the newspaper. They're at every corner.
They're very subtle.
They're very subtle. You go to an airport or a public place, and what do they have on? They have the Fox News or what we call the War Channel. You know, and this is just, if you go to the stadium, I went to a sporting event, and on the announcement, as people were walking up and approaching the stadium, thousands of people milling and walking into the stadium, what comes on the announcement but that standard voice that you hear, there are no weapons of mass destruction allowed in the Metrodome. And I'm like, well, we can't bring our briefcase apparently into the Metrodome. I was kidding with the people I was with. Hey, let's take the briefcase back, you know. But, you know, this is what, you know, that programming that, you know, and of course Big Brother, people identify with that. But the point is, it's much different than that. We live in a world that's extremely complicated. And the whole issue that if you look at science and bad science and astronomy, it's very important because it prevents people from understanding their true history.
Yes.
If people understood their true history, or let me say it a different way, if the leaders can destroy the connection of people with their true history, then they're very easy to control. Let's just take an example of banking interest, which was outlawed in the old texts, in the ancient texts. Interest on loans is very specific. It's called a usury fee. And it's usually a 1 or 2% of the amount loaned, and it is paid back with the debt. But compound interest and amortization schedule are basically outlawed. And the reason is because in the old way of viewing a loan in the ancient history, it was a benefit to society. Somebody who had wealth could loan it, and he was considered a benefactor, and that's where that name comes from. But if you look at the term amortize, which means you pay all the interest up front, amortize actually comes from a Latin word that means to kill.
Wow.
And so what it means is you're killing the person that you're loaning the money to, yet a banker will tell you that they're doing you a favor because your interest goes down with time. And in the book, I say that's like giving a thirsty man an almost empty glass of water and saying it's full up to the bottom. It's a trick. It's a play on words.
I've never heard that term, full up to the bottom.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, but that's the type of trickery. And if you can fool the public into believing that this is the way it is and this is the normal way to do business, then they are, and of course, amortization or compound interest is only leading to one thing, and that is the demise of the society, because you're literally sucking the hard labor out of everything that everybody does.
Absolutely.
And everything that everybody buys, every time somebody makes a movement, it just draws the energy out. One of my shows recently, I started out the show by talking about birds. And I said, what if a goose or a swan flying south for the winter were taxed on his efforts, so that the goose, with every swing of his wings, would be taxed 40% of his energy, and that if he ate food along the way, 40% of it would be taken away before he ate it, so he would only get 60%, and then as he flew, he had interest compounded on his efforts, so that when he got to where he was going, he didn't sit in the water and rest, he had to work. And so you can see that what man is doing today is simply paying debt. And that's right, with the government debt, which we don't control. It's totally out of control. And, you know, that's why the eternal wars are there, because it simply creates debt.
Yeah. One thing I want to talk about here and bring in, because if people are listening right now, you have a brilliant connection here when you talk about debt, which is simply, it's gone up again exponentially over the last couple of years. And then you also bring in, when you talk about the diamond principle, the latest big horrific news that's going to be with us for some time, and that is the BP oil spill. This new book, brilliant as you write, is, again, gives us a sense of the past, but also gives us some hope for the future. So as you're listening now, know that the book really connects some of those dots, and we will do that as we continue in this particular program. One of the things I've always been moved by, Jim, as you talk about math and physics, your background as a professor, is that in good science, good math, good physics, you had to have, we're dealing with a more complex equation here that is in some ways very complex, but in other ways it really isn't, because you, in order to have, or to solve a problem, you need to have the right numbers, the accurate numbers, to understand the rest of what you need to do with the equation. And we have been given the wrong numbers, and we built everything else upon, let's say, bad math, bad astronomy, bad science. So in some ways, it's no surprise that we are where we are today.
Right, right. And it does come down to bad scientific information. And so the book is kind of structured where first it goes through the situation we're in today. But now let me define people's, let's say, preconceived notions. So let's say someone were to write a book and come along and say it's bad to have the military because they use too many resources. Okay, then people would say, well, it doesn't matter because we have to fight those terrorists over there. And what they have are these little trapdoors that have been set up by society that if you say something, they automatically have a little trapdoor, and 99% of the people have all these little trapdoors to diffuse logic and reason and good sense. And so what I had to do in writing the book is I had to do an end run around everything that was in the bracket of preconceived notions. So what I did is I said, okay, let's imagine that the way the book starts out is I say, if a man were to discover a diamond on Earth, he's the first man ever to discover a diamond, and he understands the brilliance and the value, the beauty of the stone. He goes, would he think that this is the only one and hide it and and say, I found the only diamond? Well, of course not. He would look for more. Mm-hmm. And as he looked for more, he would catalog the type of place that these were found in, the conditions. And then as the society or the person became aware of the cosmos and, say, had equipment that he could see galaxies and distant stars, etc., would he begin to imagine there must be diamonds out there made by the same processes, equal in structure and in form? And if you took a gemologist and struck that diamond found on the far side of the universe, would you have all of the same properties of a diamond that you found on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a universal truth. It's a universal situation. And then you expand this concept to genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we find is that if you, then I introduced the concept that I learned with the Calculate Primes work. And this is very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
It's very subtle. That if you, in the process of calculating prime numbers, mm-hmm. something that nobody thought was possible, every mathematician for 2,500 years has worked on this problem, and I finally found the core solution in the generator function that generates groups of prime numbers. You start out with the number 0 and 1. You generate the next group, which is bigger. That generates the next group of primes when you put it into the generator function. Then you take that group of numbers and you put it back into the generator function and you get another larger group of prime mm-hmm. numbers. So you generate families of prime numbers. And it's a very subtle concept. It's very different than counting 1, 2, 3, 4,
mm-hmm.
5. Or looking at the prime numbers as a linear progression of numbers
right.
that don't
right.
fit in the multiplication table.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, something very strange happens. And it almost put the brakes on me. It almost made me stop many times. But I had to work through it, and I
mm-hmm.
did. You have to generate false primes, what I call false primes. And those then in turn generate real primes, but the false primes drop out by using the generator equation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a most amazing
yeah.
phenomenon to see.
Wow.
But you have to generate false primes, some false primes, to get real primes out
mm-hmm.
there. Some of the real primes would never appear if you did not generate those false primes. So then I applied that to genetics, DNA, the nucleotides that are built up of hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen,
mm-hmm.
and carbon.
Right.
And these are basic structures now that have actually been discovered in outer space.
Mm.
And so the point is that if you went to the far side of the universe, these nucleotides would be built up because they're naturally formed molecules, just like ammonia, just like long chain hydrocarbons, just like benzene, just like
mm-hmm.
any other chemical,
yeah.
the
yeah.
nucleotides would be built in the chemical factories any place in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take them and you put them into a genetic type of generator function
mm.
and you come out with the same thing. So there should be people very similar to us on the far side of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a natural development, but part of the interesting issue is here that you need false starts.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many, many false starts to get up to where we come along as
mm-hmm.
intelligent species. But are we really that intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
We think, we're smart, we have computers, we put somebody in space, you
right.
know, this kind of thing. But really, we're not that intelligent. We're not a species that is going to be successful. And that's another part of the Diamond Principle,
mm-hmm.
that the species that we are looking at today is a failure.
Yeah. We were raised, most of us, with this Nietzschean view of humankind, the fact that we would somehow continue to evolve and it would all get better, and that should actually stratify across every aspect of our existence, our quality of life, our stress levels, our health, our economics, and yet we seem to be, when you talk about entropy, I mean, this is order going to disorder. And the more I read of your work and I hear others talk about it, I think the ancients were far more they were far more advanced in their understanding of, as you talk about good science and good astronomy, they got it right.
Well, there have been societies that had a very marked view of the world, which
right.
seems
and
to
they
be,
flourished, didn't they?
Right, right, they did, until a major catastrophe came along.
Yeah.
See, now here's the catch.
Planet X.
Well, or Planet X type of objects.
And right.
See, here again we have bad science. Because most people think, asteroid. Immediately, most people are going to think an asteroid could collide into Earth. You know, and
they're both the dinosaurs and the ferns.
Yeah, but here's the problem.
Yeah.
The NASA has relied on this crashing asteroid concept to explain almost everything. Changing magnetic fields, you know. And every time something happens in outer space, if a comet has a little bit of a explosive brightening, an asteroid must have hit it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is explained by this, but more recently, scientists have taken and analyzed this. They've taken known meteor craters and looked at the biological life patterns after the impact, and what they've discovered is even right in the vicinity of the impact, the life forms continue on. They might have been diminished in population or something very locally, but these events are very local. They're not the big, massive fireball that goes around the Earth. And you have to understand that it actually happened back in the early Disney years. Space was animated. There were animations of outer space. And NASA, maybe 20, 30 years ago, realized that they could animate. And they hired Disney animators, literally. So you see a lot of spacecraft, and they're turning, and they're looking at Saturn, or looking at Neptune, or one of the planets. But it's all animated with an artist's conception in the same way. So science became something that was almost like a cartoon. And the scientists projected what was going to happen. And this is what happened with this asteroid collision concept.
Right.
But there again, not telling the whole story is part of telling a lie. Because imagine let's look at the mass extinctions. What do we know about the last mass extinction? The Holocene division there between the mastodons dying off, the saber-toothed tigers. I always love to use this example of the La Brea tar pits. Hundreds of animals dead in this tar pit, including a woman. They actually found the remains of a human woman. And so how did all these animals, the standard story is that they were so stupid, they walked into this oil pit and died and drowned. But it's just so absurd.
It is.
It just defies logic. But at the same time, you have the onset of an ice age on Earth.
Yeah.
And so then the climatologists say, oh, that's because the Atlantic currents reversed. And so every branch of science has its standard story for why all this stuff happened on Earth all at the same time, and magically, the Earth just jumped up and did all this by itself.
I have to tell the listeners that, you know, from one who came into this early on, and this is what I love about your work and others who have followed your work for years, it seems like modern science has always had to adapt. When they find a new piece of stuff, all of a sudden scientific theory changes, and yet da-da-da-da. And yet what they find and will discover in reading the Diamond Principle is that when you talk about good science and a good presupposition and understanding that embraces the truth of our beginning, you come out with good science and you have a better understanding of the universe. And I've always been amazed I understood what you were talking about in relationship to, and you talk about this, and we'll get into this later. You talk about comets, how key comets are in terms of everything we should understand about the universe that we have not understood.
Right. It's a central core issue. And so back to the Art Bell issue.
Right.
He said, there's got to be something more here. And let me just take a little example. That if people understood comets were these electrical discharges, that a hot, big object would come into the solar system, not an ice ball. It could be a small object. It could be a potato-shaped object. Or it could be something big, because there's big stuff floating around out there.
You bet there is.
If it comes into the solar system, no matter what size it is, it's going to discharge the solar capacitor. And so the point is that NASA can fool people because it's way out there. You can't see it. And so all of the glossy magazines, all the shows can continue with this facade. But imagine if the public really knew that it was a discharge of the solar capacitor, and that Earth was discharging the same solar capacitor, and that was the cause of our severe weather. that electrical current passed from outer space down actually to the surface of the Earth to drive powerful storms like hurricanes and tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize that we could tap into that power source and provide free energy, and we wouldn't need oil anymore. Do you see the line?
Scary thought, isn't it?
So that,
well, for some, anyway.
Yeah, but the point is that the science community and mm-hmm. the oil community are in cahoots.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because, first of all, this concept of peak oil is ridiculous, and that's what's mm-hmm. great about
yeah.
the BP oil spill.
Yeah, it literally blew the lid off. I mean, because we were told for years they were pumping this oil. Well, if anybody had an image of and looked at that tragedy at the bottom of the Gulf, that thing was blowing out oil like, you know, and it was extremely potent. And one of the other questions that came to my mind, not only in terms of the pumping question, but you didn't need to pump this stuff with the amount of pressure that was coming out from the Earth's crust or below it, was how many ferns and dinosaurs were the amount of oil that came out of there. I mean, it's like it really took the cap off a lot of the old science that most of us have bought into for years.
Right, and that's where one of the very first things I do in the book is I say, we all know this is a tragedy, but what's the real story in the scientific sense here?
Yeah, what is that?
You have an ocean of oil.
Yeah.
That is 18,000 feet below the subsurface of the ocean, mm-hmm. the surface that is the land surface, so to speak, under the ocean. This reservoir is 18,000 feet over almost 4 miles
mm-hmm.
down.
Amazing.
And it's under tremendous pressure.
Yeah.
And then there's 5,000 feet of water on top of that. Where were the fern forests that produced this oil? And where was the pumping mechanism that got it down there?
Well, not only that, what was blowing it out of there at a rate like, it was like you saw those images and have seen those images, and it's
yeah.
like, holy smokes, what kind of pressure
yeah.
is inside this planet to push out that much oil and volume over that period of, what, 100 plus days?
Yeah, and so here's what you've got is you have a balloon, and the pressure, the gravitational pressure on all of that material is pressing down, and people have this idea of a cavity down there that's kind of like a open hole and the oil is just kind of floating
yeah.
in there. No. The Earth is compressed, and if some oil comes out, the Earth compresses more. It caves in on that oil, and it's mm-hmm. going to maintain that pressure until every drop of oil is out that little hole. So they mm-hmm. basically punctured a hole in a pretty big balloon,
mm-hmm.
and that balloon is not going to stop until that hole is empty, and the hole is going to be flattened like a pancake.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, where did that oil come from?
That's right.
How did it get down there?
Yeah.
And how did 18,000 feet of dirt get on
yeah.
top of it?
If a picture is worth 1,000 words, if there's any good news out of a horrendous tragedy, is that it's a big wake-up call, and you address it here in the book, and you give us again some real deeper understanding of, in the Diamond Principle, about, you know, what the old science or the tier one, tier two stuff, the bad science, bad astronomy, what it's the illusion that we've been living under.
Right.
Maybe
right.
that's a better way to say it.
Right. And then it shows the collusion between astronomy,
mm-hmm.
which you have to understand. Now, I was at Cornell University
right.
in the heyday of NASA when the Voyager spacecraft were
yeah.
going out, the unmanned probes, and they ruled the roost there. I went around to many departments talking to professors.
Mm.
And they did not dare produce
yeah.
any material
right.
that contradicted this idea that the solar system formed once a long time ago and that comets were dirty snowballs and they, you know, all of the standard
yeah.
science. They didn't dare do anything that would upset that apple cart because they would have literally been out of there.
Yeah. Overnight. So they formed the science around...
Right. That things happen slowly,
mm-hmm.
the Earth did it all by itself,
mm-hmm.
nothing came in from outside to affect these major incidents. And so this is the story that's been passed off to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, understand, this is the Tier 2 science.
Right.
And we think of, Cornell University, Carl Sagan, mm-hmm. you know, the
billions and billions.
Yeah, yeah. And these are the top scientists, when in reality... The Tier 1 scientists, you never hear their names,
mm-hmm.
you never know who they are, and they're sitting up there on top, literally laughing at all of this mm-hmm. knowing fully well that it's all wrong. Mm. But from their positions, once, and I've known scientists who've been sort of plucked out of, and you can see who they are. When they first come out of grad school, they're the sharp ones. Mm-hmm. And you watch that guy, you watch this girl over here, this lady, and 99% of them, after they get out of grad school and probably long before, mm-hmm. have not had an original thought. They've simply understood yeah. that if you repeat what you're told to mm-hmm. the professor, you get an A and you're rewarded with graduating, getting out of that.
You get a diploma and then you can go out and get right. a job.
Yeah, but see, once you get a job, what do? Now you're a postdoc, you're at the bottom of the rung again. Mm-hmm. Or you get your first PhD mm-hmm. position and you're at the bottom of the rung. You might get your name last on a very long list of names in a publication. Mm-hmm. And someday you might get to lead, but you're going to do a lot of following before you do any leading. Nobody's going to come out of the chute leading. So this is a very structured apple cart. And the one thing you learn is you don't upset the apple cart.
Keep your blinders on.
Right, because the whole issue is, imagine how, you know, and that's a great term, upset the apple cart, because mm-hmm. what does it do? All the apples spill all over the place. And where is a PhD in astrophysics or space science or physics, chemistry, whatever, and they're working at NASA and they're working in geology or whatever, where are those people going to get a job?
Mm-hmm.
They are not. They are not going to find any kind of job. And I laugh jokingly, what if, you know, you can see him sitting in a McDonald's trying to get a managerial position. But, sir, I believe you're a bit overqualified. What did mm-hmm. you do before? Mm-hmm. I was a PhD nuclear plasma physicist from NASA. So I'm sorry, sir. You are overqualified for this position or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they know it.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they going to get a job? So their modus operandi is to all be in a row, all saying the same thing, and in strength there's unity. And if they all say the same thing, they all get a paycheck, and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is tier two science, and mm-hmm. this is what's fed to the public. And I watch these scientists. I just watched a NASA special the other day on pulsars and quasars. And they're repeating the standard, and
right.
they sing song. It's like a nursery rhyme, and they're all happy. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's just incredible
mm-hmm.
that this science, and that's all they do, generation after generation, mm-hmm. repeat the same thing, but it's 99% of it is all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They don't include electrical parts of the aspects of the universe, mm-hmm. which is not dominant. Gravity is dominant. It's a very subtle mm-hmm. combination of effects, but electricity has major effects that occur.
Absolutely. And that also, when you talk about the Diamond Principle, again, this book embraces really every other book that you've written. You talk about Tesla in here, and you talk about, when you talk about electrical properties, you really go into some depth here with regards to not just an analysis of the problem and how did we get to where we are today, but you give us some real hope in building a bridge and giving us a good scientific basis on if indeed we are willing to, for the sake of humanity's survival, readjust our thinking, let you come around the back door and open our eyes to what is possible with, I think Tesla was a genius. I mean, if indeed we can readjust our thinking and begin to incorporate good science for the sake of the future.
Right. Well, this is the end run, and it's a
right.
good time to introduce this.
Yes.
Because so far we've been talking mainly about social issues, about
right.
bad science and how it affects people or tier one science. But And talking about the trapdoors that people have in their minds. So what I did in this book is I did an end run around all of this, and I said, let's imagine that collectively as a civilization, as a society, as a culture, as a species, we decided to embrace a program to preserve the genetic strain, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
We know that something, I mean, even if you believe that an asteroid is going to crash into
mm-hmm.
Earth, we still have the same result. We're not going to live on this planet forever
mm-hmm.
in peace and harmony. The universe has another plan,
mm-hmm.
and we don't know what the time schedule for that plan is. It could be next year. It could be in 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I take the kind of the the first thing I make a point of is that a government program to put people in space to preserve the species would not work. And I show all of the reasons. I show why venture capital would not work.
Mm-hmm.
All of the standard processes that are in place today that we use to do business or go into space wouldn't work. So then we have 6 billion people in the Earth. The Earth has some major problems right here. We're running out of resources. The militaries of the Earth are chewing up tremendous amounts of resources.
Incredible.
And so the thing I had to do is do a complete end run around all of the little trapdoors that people have and said, what if a group of people, a subgroup of society, went about and decided that we want to preserve the species? Well, the first thing you have to realize is that as a society, we are in no way, shape, or form capable of even beginning a program like that, because as a society, there's no personal responsibility. We would be moving society into space. Plus, it's a technical problem of moving all of our environment into outer space.
We'd be putting old wine in new wineskins.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and trying to make a silk purse out of a pig's ear.
There you go.
And that's society today. So this first part of the book is really an analysis of society today from that perspective. If we were to do something major, and this is something, that's why I had to do an end run around all of the people's norms and misconceptions of today. But then I show, as I work through the Diamond Principle, that understanding the electrical nature of the universe, understanding that there are electric currents in outer space that we can ride to the next planet, not using chemical propulsion. I showed that chemical propulsion could not possibly get us into outer space. I showed that we have to get vast numbers of people into space, but the government programs promise to put 3 people on the moon in 20 years.
I like your science better. And your math.
Yeah. So what I'm showing is that as a society and the norms that have been set up in front of us.
Yeah.
And also, let's take just a shuttle launch or the old Saturn V moon rocket launch with the crowds and the throngs of people standing 2 miles back and hear this.
Dr. Cronkite saying, look at that.
You did that pretty good.
Well, I'm fascinated by the space program, but, you know, I always. If you grew up like on Flash Gordon and you were a Trekkie, you know, I think Gene Roddenberry was brilliant. You know, he didn't have everything there, but there's another context of the universe that it's never felt quite right. And you're the only guy that's put it together that when you talk about that, I'm fascinated by this, you know, what we've done. We are like so primitive and there's so much more. And that's where, again, your work, when you explained on my program more than once, a bit about comets and the electrical nature of the universe, and then you began to talk about Tesla. The other possibilities are there, and you talk about this in the book. They're endless.
Right.
We can do it.
Right. And here's one of the biggest concepts of the Diamond Principle is that nature, on the far side of the universe as well as here, has provided very simple, very effective ways to travel in space.
Yes.
Very effective ways to build space stations. Very effective ways to live out there. Very effective ways to travel between the stars. And literally, with the design of the spaceship, we're all used to seeing, that's what I'm saying, this misconception, bad tier two science.
The Saturn.
The big plume of smoke, and everybody's taking their pictures, and they go home, and look at, I saw the shuttle take off, and they think that this is the most advanced thing in space. The people are so bamboozled, and that is not the way to go into space.
When they talk about smoke and mirrors, sometimes when I hear you talk about that now, it's like, okay, when I'm watching that, what else are they doing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the real point is there is a private space program going on behind the scenes with the real funding. NASA is simply a dog and pony show. Just like politics. And I talk about politics. And I talk about the American public being the downfall of the entire world. Because we have let our leaders go amok, awry, and be controlled from outside. And so a big point of the Diamond Principle is that society, now this is also looking from the perspective of, say we know that imminently in 200 years something is going to come by Earth, or let's say 20 years,
mm-hmm.
that's not very much time. Even 200 years is
right.
not much time to get a massive number of people into space to preserve the species.
Mm-hmm.
If we knew this planet was going to get wiped clean. But then, ask yourself a question, very simple question. If that's going to happen, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's driving up and down the highway every day in SUVs and burning up oil and burning
that's
up,
right.
polluting the earth to death, harvesting all the fish out of the sea. There's nothing left. All the resources
mm-hmm.
are going. And you have to look and see that 99.9% of everything we're doing, we're just marching down the wrong road with 99% of what we're doing.
Because
you wouldn't do this if you had to expend the effort to do something concentrated.
Exactly.
So the as you go through the Diamond Principle, the whole point is that a diamond is a gem with many facets.
Mm-hmm.
And all the facets, when you look into a diamond, reflect off of each other. And look, they all have a very specific combination. And
mm-hmm.
so when I chose the topic, the Diamond Principle, the whole concept is that all of these aspects of life and science, we live in a vibrant, active, scientific universe.
Mm-hmm.
We live in it. It affects us. We
Amazing.
Affect it. And,
yeah.
and it's nature has designed the methods for us to travel amongst the stars,
mm-hmm.
and we're watching a smokestack of a space shuttle go off and thinking that this is good.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a diversion. Every time that space shuttle goes off and people watch it, we have lost a day, we have lost a year, we've
mm-hmm.
lost 10 years,
yeah.
because people think that that's good.
Yeah.
And there are people who are interested in science, but what has to happen on a massive scale is really to re-educate the public.
Mm-hmm.
And
as you talk about the second half of your book, you really take us through that too, and talking about diamonds from electric comets. This is brilliant. I've never seen, when you talk about a picture being worth 1,000 words, you've really given us that picture here, because you have, 22 chapters, and you, again, in the first half, give us an analysis of how we got to where we are now and what we need to do to turn it around. But this new understanding of scientists and propulsion systems, diamonds themselves, interesting metaphor. And one of the things we were talking about the other night when you talk about diamonds, interestingly enough, it's like you find a diamond, this incredibly hard, beautiful piece of, it's a diamond. And oftentimes right around it is very soft material. Is that a metaphor at all for what we need to understand?
Well, the whole idea, the traditional concept of diamonds, and here again, cannot possibly be true. The,
right.
the traditional concept is that diamonds formed early, billions of years ago, early in the Earth's history, deep in the Earth under tremendous pressure and temperature,
mm-hmm.
and then found these volcanic flux tubes where they came up and then landed near the surface, and that's where they're mined today.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it closely, first of all, the material that the diamonds are embedded in is much softer than the diamonds.
Yeah.
So how did this tremendous pressure get put on the diamonds? Now, you can make a diamond with an artificial pressure device, and you can actually create a diamond. But the pressure you put on has to be harder than the diamond as it's
mm-hmm.
forming. So these diamonds formed supposedly in this bed of material
mm-hmm.
down deep in the earth, but when they come up, they're in a material that's much softer than the diamond. So how did you get the pressure onto the diamond? And the
mm-hmm.
end result is that that is not how they formed
mm-hmm.
at all.
Okay.
The point is that the Earth formed as a comet, just
mm-hmm.
like Venus the comet, just like the other planets
mm-hmm.
formed, as they were comets moving through the solar system, picking up material. And in the, let me explain an experiment that was done actually by mistake. And also, you were mentioning, we were talking about diamonds have been discovered in outer space,
mm-hmm.
free floating with nothing else around them, nothing attached
yeah.
to them, just a diamond. there are some stars that have so many diamonds around them, entire belts of diamonds, that the diamonds are visible from Earth. So it's an incredible situation.
Wow.
And so these are X-ray stars, so just remember the idea of X-rays. Now, comets, to the sunward side, have an intense electron beam that comes out of the sun. Mm-hmm. This is part of the electrical discharge, the plasma discharge comet model.
Right.
That gives you the properties. Let me go back to another experiment that was done. That scientists mistakenly, they had a vacuum chamber with carbon gas in it.
Mm-hmm.
They introduced an electron current, a current of electrons, and they formed microdiamonds in the chamber. Somehow, magically, these diamonds formed. So anyway, they went to discover and try and find out the reason for this. And what happened is the carbon would form a sphere, and actually these are now known as Bucky spheres after Buckminster Fuller, who came up with this idea for very strong structures for building buildings.
Yeah.
But they can also form in a complete circle with the carbon bonding.
Hmm.
So what happens is that forms a what they call onions. These are concentric circles or spheres of carbon spheres,
mm-hmm.
microcarbon spheres, very strong. And within that, then the pressures are significant enough to form a diamond.
Wow.
And this happens when you have free carbon gas and an electron beam.
Okay.
Now, a comet...
That's where diamonds come from.
From the nose side of a very intense comet.
Yeah.
And so remember that X-rays have been discovered to the sunward side of comets. And so the X-ray stars where you see the X-ray activity and all the diamonds, guess what? Comets.
Hmm.
And so these are all associations. So the chapter on comets generating or being the source of diamonds, then again, that explains how they're found deep in the Earth, because Earth started with a core object that came into the solar system, very intense electron beam coming in the nose side as Earth formed and then became a planet. And of course, the science on how this works is explained in detail in the earlier books, in the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, and in the other books.
Yeah.
So.
And that's one thing that people need to know here. This is a nice summary, too, of all of your work. In some ways, I find it hard to really find the words to explain what the Diamond Principle is about. And it's wonderful to read. It's accessible. It does embrace each one of your other works in a very meaningful way. As you talk about the progression here, one word that comes to mind is sustainable, because in various conversations throughout the years, and you talk about this in the latter portion of the book, to the question, is life in outer space sustainable? And you say yes, with good science, it is. And you take us into some better understanding of how and why you say yes, life is sustainable out there.
Well, imagine, I always use this example, imagine that NASA had the contract or whatever to explore the Old West.
Mm-hmm.
I always say they would have had one covered wagon with three people in it, and it would have had everything possible, and it would have had a supply route back to home so that they could get Tang and other things. And they would have gone out to the West Coast, found the Pacific Ocean, and when the word came back, it would have been declared top secret. And we would all be living on the East Coast still.
Yeah.
This is if NASA were given the job of exploring the Old West. No, but what happened? We just sent people out there. They didn't know where to go or
what to do.
They learned everything as they went.
Yeah. And if they didn't have the tools, they had the wherewithal to be able to think that they could actually create them, and they did.
Right, right. And so that's the way outer space is. You have to just send people out there, and they're going to start to learn how to live and do this and don't do this. And and we have to send large numbers of people out there.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you do that? Certainly not with the kind of space program we have now. So what you realize is that the space program as it is currently designed is meant to prevent the average person from ever thinking about going into outer space.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, bad science. And the end result is that you cannot go into outer space. You can't even think about it, because only NASA, with a 20-year budget of billions of dollars, could ever possibly do this.
Yeah.
And the space shuttle and all of the, you know, the building and everything, when the top engineers know fully well that's not the way to go into space.
In closing this particular segment in the conversation about the Diamond Principle, a few moments ago you were talking about the exponential effect that, you know, we can use that for good or for, you know, we can use it to redeem ourselves or to continue to self-destruct, and let's say it like that. I have noticed in my own experience that when you work with people, and I say this for the people out there that are thinking, well, it's too overwhelming, it's, you know, just too much work. But it's amazing what can be done when you begin to work with people together with a compassionate heart, number one, and number two, with what is right and what works. In other words, you organize, you work with good science, you work together, you work for the common good, and you work out of a heart of compassion. And that exponential effect for redemption is huge.
I'm going to read the very first page of the book, because this book is dedicated to youth and the future, ingenuity of man, compassion of the heart, excitement of discovery, longevity of each person, and our birthright to the stars.
Yes. Our time here has gone, as always, Jim, very quickly. The Diamond Principle, your new book, it embraces really your life's work in a very meaningful way. There's a progression here that is unprecedented in terms of the past and the future, hope for the future, and in a time when we're all asking lots of questions, feeling a bit overwhelmed, the Diamond Principle is a brilliant work. Jim was a guest of mine many times in my years at CBS Radio, always one of my favorite guests. And we're going to continue in the next program with part two of this work, because there's so much here. The Diamond Principle, and where do we go, Jim, to find the book and order the book?
The webpage, JMCC,
mm-hmm.
S as in science, C as in Charlie, I as in indigo.com,
mm-hmm.
JMCCSCI.com, and the book is available there, along with all of the other books.
Yeah.
And the book was written, The Diamond Principle, because many people, this will be their first introduction to my work.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be sold on a much broader scale. But then it introduces the other works, and people should go back and first read The Diamond Principle, then go back and read the other books.
Okay. And also, on the website, if you go to the website, there are a few segments of this interview that you'll be able to catch at the website that will not be broadcast here on the radio. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Brad.